From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, President Obama outlines steps to be taken in the fight against terrorism. Libya appeals to the UN for lifting an arms embargo. The AJC links European and Jewish security following terror attacks. And striking back at the modern iGorilla.
We take a network to fight a network. We use an iForce.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House Summit on Countering Violent Extremism has listed several actions the international community should take to combat the terrorism crisis of the day. First, he said, governments must remain unwavering in the fight against terrorist organizations. Second, he said, we need to confront what he called the warped ideologies of terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL, especially their attempt to use Islam to justify their violence.
These terrorists are desperate for legitimacy. And all of us have a responsibility to refute the notion that groups like ISIL somehow represent Islam, because that is a falsehood that embraces the terrorist narrative. At the same time, we must acknowledge that groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL are deliberately targeting their propaganda to Muslim communities, particularly Muslim youth. Now, Muslim communities, including scholars and clerics, therefore have a responsibility to push back, not just on twisted interpretations of Islam, but also on the lie that we are somehow engaged in a clash of civilizations, that America and the West are somehow at war with Islam, or seek to suppress Muslims, or that we are the cause of every ill in the Middle East.
Third, the president said, governments must address the grievances terrorists exploit, including economic grievances.
Poverty alone does not cause a person to become a terrorist any more than poverty alone causes someone to become a criminal. There are millions, billions of people who are poor and are law-abiding and peaceful and tolerant and are trying to advance their lives and the opportunities for their families. But when people, especially young people, feel entirely trapped in impoverished communities where there is no order and no path for advancement, where there are no educational opportunities, where there are no ways to support families and no escape from injustice and the humiliations of corruption, that feeds instability and disorder.
The president said governments must address the political concerns that terrorists exploit, and they must welcome people of all faiths and backgrounds.
Groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIL peddle the lie that some of our countries are hostile to Muslims. Meanwhile, we've also seen, most recently in Europe, a rise in inexcusable acts of anti-Semitism, or in some cases, anti-Muslim sentiment, or anti-immigrant sentiment. When people spew hatred towards others because of their faith or because they are immigrants, it feeds into terrorist narratives. If entire communities feel they can never become a full part of the society in which they reside, it feeds a cycle of fear and resentment and a sense of injustice upon which extremists prey. We can't allow cycles of suspicions to tear at the fabric of our countries. So we all recognize the need for more dialogues across countries and cultures. Those efforts are indeed important. But what's most needed today, perhaps, are more dialogues within countries. Not just across faiths, but also within faiths.
U.S. President Barack Obama at the White House Summit on Countering Violent Extremism today. Libya has appealed to the U.N. Security Council to lift a four-year arms embargo so its forces can fight the growing presence of the Islamic State in the North African country. The call came 4 days after a video appeared showing ISIL militants beheading 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians in Libya. The video prompted Egypt's government to launch airstrikes at ISIL's targets in its neighbor. Libya's foreign minister told the council the global community has a legal and moral responsibility to act, and failure to do so will play into the hands of extremists. Jordan is circulating a draft resolution among council members that would lift the embargo and calls on all militia to leave the capital, Tripoli, to allow the return of the legitimate government. The country has two rival governments, an internationally recognized parliament in the east, and a rival backed by some Islamist militia in the capital. Libya has struggled with militia violence since the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. ISIL fighters have taken advantage of the chaos and reportedly have taken control of two coastal cities, Sirte and Derna. Amin Saikal, director of the Australian National University's Center of Arab and Islamic Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, despite the push to lift the arms embargo by Arab nations, the West appears unwilling to support it.
The Libyan government is not in control of all of the country, and if the arms embargo is lifted, then the fear of the Western powers would be that some of their advanced arms could easily fall into the hands of wrong groups in Libya, just as has really happened in the case of Iraq, where, for example, the Islamic State succeeded in seizing a lot of modern American arms, which had been supplied to the Iraqi government, but they are being used against the United States and the Iraqi government and other forces by the Islamic State.
UN envoy Bernardino Leon told the council that political efforts to broker a deal on forming a unity government in Libya could soon yield results. Quote, I am hopeful a political agreement can be reached soon. The differences between the parties are not insurmountable. Now, these two groups, the nationalists and the Islamists, have actually been fighting each other over the control of Libya's oil ports and cities. Is it possible a political solution?
I think a political solution is probably the best means available at this point. And I think the UN envoy is absolutely right that I think at this stage there is little room for military intervention which could really salvage the situation. I think what is really required, a very strong mediation on the part of the UN and, of course, with the support of regional organizations to bring the two sides together in order to reach some sort of understanding. I know that they are both ideologically very much apart. One is sort of a nationalist and the other Islamist, and some of these Islamist groups have already sided with the Islamic State, and of course that's created a very dangerous situation. But on the other hand, I don't see any military solution to the problem which could really bring peace and stability to Libya very quickly.
Is it possible that even with a national unity government, Libya would be able to expel the Islamic State militants that seem now to have a firm foothold in at least two cities, Sirte and Derna?
If they are not able to expel them, at least they might be in a position to marginalize them, and hopefully trying to bring them on board in medium to long run. I don't think there is a really short-term solution to these issues, and I think Libya is on a path of more bloodshed and more conflict.
How concerning is the presence of IS in Libya to Tunisia, to Egypt, and to Europe?
Well, it is very concerning, and Gaddafi was certainly removed, but that's the problem with a personalized state. What he had really done, that he created a personalized state, then when that person is removed, then the whole structure of the state collapses, and this is what's precisely happened.
If the UN Security Council fails to act on Libya over these differences, will Egypt take a more proactive approach to dealing with Libya?
I think Egypt will probably do that, but at the same time, Egyptian resources will be really quite limited, and I'm not really sure whether President al-Sisi will be prepared to really commit ground forces into Libya and get into a major conflict, which he may not really win, because there are so many forces now operating in Libya. The Egyptian forces could easily be caught in a civil war. At the same time, also, Egypt has got its own domestic problems, and as well as real serious security problems in the Sinai Peninsula. So Egypt, I don't think, is in a position to stretch its military prowess out too much. As we know, no conflict is going to be won from the air, and the IS is not going to be dislodged in Libya from the air, just in the same way that so far the United States and its allies have not been able to dislodge IS in Iraq through air operations alone.
Amin Saikal, director of the Australian National University's Center of Arab and Islamic Studies. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is urging the United Nations to endorse an international military campaign against the extremist group that claims to have executed 21 Egyptian Christians in Libya. Samer Shahada is a political scientist at the University of Oklahoma. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with him about the recent rise of extremist violence in Egypt and the surrounding region.
Professor Shahata, 4 years after ousting former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, how would you describe the situation in Egypt right now?
The situation in Egypt right now is quite far from democracy and quite far from what the millions of protesters had hoped when they ousted Mr. Mubarak. They wanted a democratic Egypt, an Egypt where there was social justice, economic opportunities, and growth, and for people to be treated with dignity by the government. And unfortunately, none of that has materialized. There are thousands of people in prison. The democratic system is not transparent and open. The society is deeply polarized. And there are multiple parties to blame between those who support the current government and those who are critical of it, particularly Islamists and the Muslim Brotherhood. So these are very difficult times in Egypt presently.
Where do you expect Egypt to be heading after the upcoming parliamentary elections being the so-called final step in the roadmap?
Well, I don't think that the situation is going to change significantly or improve, really, as a result of the upcoming parliamentary election scheduled for March 2015. I think what everyone can agree on is that any parliament that is elected is not going to be a powerful parliament, a powerful check to the power of the president, the general-turned-president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who has, of course, the backing of the military and the security apparatus, and also millions of people behind him. So, unfortunately, that kind of check and balance or a counterbalance isn't going to be realized. It doesn't look like there are going to be powerful political parties that emerge that win significant number of votes. And even if they do, it doesn't look like they're going to be able to stand up to President Sisi.
The economic situation seems to be the most challenging problem facing Egypt 4 years after the popular uprising. What's your assessment of the Egyptian government handling of this problem?
I think that the most pressing problem, really, is a political problem, and that the economics comes afterwards. We'll speak about economics in a moment, but I think that the society is incredibly polarized, incredibly divided. There's a great deal of repression and also insecurity. As you know, there are, unfortunately, acts of terrorism and killing. Hundreds of members of the security forces have been killed. There's an insurgency going on in Sinai and so on. So I think the political situation is foremost, but you are right. The economic situation is also very important. And this government has tried to undertake some economic reform measures. They, of course, reduced fuel subsidies some months back. They've issued a new system of subsidies, unlike the blanket subsidies of many years where everybody would be able to obtain, for example, subsidized bread and some other commodities. Now there's a system that's more targeted towards those who have lower incomes. And this seems to be winning praise from the International Monetary Fund and other institutions. And there's money coming in from the Gulf countries. But the real structural change that's needed, a fundamental change that really produces improvement in human quality of life, but for the majority of Egyptians, I think is still far away. Because unless you deal with the political issues, unless you deal with systematic corruption, unless you invest, significant resources in education and health, you really aren't going to see a qualitative change. And we don't see any realization even of the magnitude of the scale of the problems that Egypt faces.
Final question. What needs to be done for a better transition to democracy in Egypt? And do you see any role for the U.S. or the international community in helping Egypt moving toward democracy?
Well, the things that need to be done and which will not be done, of course, are a peaceful, inclusive, democratic process in the context of institutions, and here I mean a constitution and laws that provide equality of citizenship and a protection of rights for all Egyptians, whether they're Christian or Muslim, men or women, rich or poor, young and old, and so on. So that's not going to happen, unfortunately, because what we have is really the dominance of the political and economic system by some elements in society to the exclusion and detriment, I think, of many others. Now, what will the United States do? The United States also has been quite poor in its willingness to stand up for principles, principles of democracy, principles of the right of peaceful protest, of due justice and process of law, and so on. I mean, there are dozens of journalists in jail, as I said, thousands of political prisoners. But the United States has largely, despite occasional rhetoric, been willing to do business with Egypt, business as usual, that is, supplying military aid, supplying attack helicopters, and supplying some political cover, and not pressing enough for the basic rights and freedoms that I think all people deserve.
Samer Shahata with the University of Oklahoma. Two recent terrorist attacks have followed a similar pattern. First, in France, deadly attacks on the Charlie Hebdo satirical magazine and on a kosher grocery. Then in Denmark, bloody attacks on a free speech seminar and later a synagogue. The second is not officially being called a copycat assault, but has heightened concern among the Jewish community. David Harris is executive director of the American Jewish Committee in New York. We asked him the effects of these raids.
It creates tremendous fear and anxiety, questions about the future for Jews in Europe, but it also creates uncertainty about Europe itself and the future of the continent. As you said in your introduction, there's a linkage. There were attacks on European values, such as freedom of speech and freedom of the press, and there were attacks on Jews. In other words, there were attacks on Europe and what it stands for. So the future is in question both for Jews and, frankly, for Europe itself.
Well, what steps are needed to protect your community? What can be done?
A lot. I've been spending the last 15 years, that's 15 years, together with my AJC colleagues, traveling in Europe, meeting with European leaders, and trying to call attention to the growing threat both to Jewish communities and to European values. And we got a mixed reaction, always polite, but in many cases a reaction of denial. Now Europe has to face the magnitude of the problem. There is a threat. It comes from within Europe, and it comes from the periphery of Europe. Europe has to acknowledge the threat, call it by its real name, which is jihadist radicalism, Islamic radicalism, and it has to strengthen its will and its determination on many, many fronts, from intelligence and surveillance to justice, to the police, to education, to take on this challenge. And it won't be an overnight issue. It's not about one speech or two speeches. It's about a long-term determination to defend Europe's values and Europe's communities, including Jews, in order to save Europe.
Sometimes, though, when they try to improve the situation, they can actually take away some rights that people have. It's a fine line there.
Well, there is a fine line, but the first line and the first right is the right to security and the right to life. And right now, the right to security and the right to life are both being threatened, as we've seen now in Belgium, in France, in Denmark, and elsewhere. And Europe is under threat. And when you add to this the fact that there are now an estimated 3,000-plus Europeans currently fighting in Iraq and in Syria, the European fear is what happens when they return to Europe. They will be battle-hardened, battle-tested, and are they going to go back to peaceful pursuits, or are they going to carry on their jihadist struggle within Europe? So this is an immense challenge. Europe is a democratic zone. It need not apologize for its democracy, but it also has to defend itself and its core values, which are under assault.
You mentioned what the authorities should do, but is there anything within your community that you can do other than visiting and talking with people?
Well, the Jewish community, acting on its own, can do very little. It's a small minority of Europe. What it can do, though, is continue to urge European authorities to provide full protection, full security, and full support. And many European countries today are waking up to that reality. I would particularly point to France, took a while to figure out the challenge, but the Prime Minister of France today is probably the most determined and courageous of European leaders who understands, and he has said that France without the Jews is no longer France. And I would add, Europe without the Jews would no longer be Europe. So the future of Europe and the future of Jewish communities in Europe are completely intertwined. You can't separate one from the other. So Jewish security depends on European security, and European security, I would argue, also depends on Jewish security.
David Harris, executive director of the American Jewish Committee in New York. John Sutherland, a senior analyst with the Department of Defense and author, was speaking with us Wednesday about a new face of war, the iGorilla. He says they are part of the younger generation that is competent with the new social media and organized as a virtual network. Today we ask, how do we fight an iGorilla?
Well, in my opinion, and I say in my book, we take a network to fight a network. We use an iForce, enabling our troops to swarm. And the way we would do that, and we actually have experimented with it, and in 2006 in the city of Mosul, it happened as a consequence of just trying to survive, and it turned out to be very successful. So what we did was you push power down to the lower levels, battalions, companies, sometimes even platoons, and they're allowed to make their decisions at the lower level. They also share their missions and their targets with other units in the area, like an Army unit could share with a Special Forces unit and likewise could share with the Marine unit. So they all kind of know what each other is doing. And when they engage, they can actually collaborate directly at the lower level. The way the military was built was to fight conventional wars against the major army. And so things going up the chain, decisions made there and then coming back down made sense. But the fight is really dynamic now. It's more like cops on the beat, so that each troop out there needs to be able to call for higher level support like air or artillery and direct them immediately at the lowest level. And we've done that, and what we need to do now is kind of codify that, train that, and be prepared to use that as a way to fight these guerrilla-type wars.
Well, tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, I open up with describing how and why things changed. And I really think it goes back to the collapse of the Soviet Union back in 1991. Back in the Cold War days, everybody pretty much had to take sides. You were either with the Russians, the Soviets, or you were with the Americans, the capitalists. And any event, any incident had the potential of escalating into a nuclear face-off between those two great powers, superpowers. And because of that, everybody in the world, whether they liked it or not, they were aligned and they had to keep their radicals under wraps because nobody wanted to be the ones who caused, you know, a face-off. And so everything was monitored and regulated and tracked. Trade, travel, communications, exchange of information, all that stuff was controlled very tightly. I don't think you ever would have seen a 9/11 during the Cold War or an attack on a theater in Moscow during the Cold War. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, all the old motivations for war were unleashed. We saw that with the collapse of the old Soviet Union. There was a dozen or so former Soviet republics that left, and they did so based on ethnic nationalism. And ethnic nationalism was not allowed to be a motive for war during the Cold War days. So anyways, I think the collapse of the Soviet Union opened up all these new motivations for war, whether they were ethnic or sectarian based on religion. So I describe how that changed. And with the globalization, the liberalization of and democratization of travel, knowledge, sharing knowledge, information, communications, it unleashed a whole set of tools that all these new movements could put into work. And so it describes how the insurgents in the world kind of gradually woke up to the fact that they could travel around easily. They could talk across borders easily. And by using the internet, they could recruit indirectly rather than going face to face. And local causes could be turned into global causes. And so all these things kind of roll together, kind of super empowering these small groups that back in the old days would have been marginalized, very local, back of the newspaper type of event.
Author and senior analyst with the Defense Department, John Sutherland. He stresses that his views are his own, not the government's. The book, iGorilla, Reshaping the Face of War in the 21st Century, is to be released in March. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.